So before I start, I want to just emphasize that Game of Death has a particular significance to me. Significance, I should say, to me, because it was the first Bruce Lee film that I ever saw. I was about 7.5 years old. This was the version that I saw, 1978 Game of Death film. And for me, it was transformative, right? The opening sequence using John Barry's score that swiped the ending of Way of the Dragon, where he fights Chuck Norris in the Coliseum, and the finale that we just saw right here, to me, after seeing that, like, that set my path and my interest on Bruce Lee for, you know, to come. So it was a very significant, you know, film, even though it was a pretty bad film that, you know, overall, you know, that only ended up using a certain amount of the footage. It's important to remember that this was Bruce's sophomore effort as a director, right? He began principal shooting in August of 1972 and off and on until October, mid-October or so. The stuff that he shot was actually 90 minutes worth of material that included a whole lot of outtakes that they ended up only using 12 minutes of. Bruce then left to go shoot Enter the Dragon for Warner Brothers, and the intent was to come back and finish Game of Death in the fall of 1973. Sadly, he passed away July 20th and wasn't able to do that. So a few years later, Raymond Chow got the director of Enter the Dragon, Robert Klaus, to basically weave a storyline around this footage and you know, wanted to capitalize on it. So what they ended up coming up with is a plot that kind of mirrored almost the final 2 years of Bruce Lee's life from the perspective of rumors. So the film was about a martial arts actor named Billy Lowe who was being pressed by the mob. They wanted to control his career. So he ends up kind of faking his own death and then going to fight them in a restaurant, not a pagoda, but, you know, I guess the restaurant was supposed to sell for the pagoda at that point. And it's a really, really bad film that, you know, that it almost falls in the category of it's so bad it's good. You know, I don't know if anyone's ever had that experience. Where it's like, you know, maybe it's just a little bit of nostalgia on my end because I watched the film like ad nauseum because that's all I had, you know, when I was young. So it's like stuff just kind of seeps in. And like, you know, you're like, wow, you know, was it really a bad film? Or yeah, it has to be, right? But anyway, fast forward to the late 90s. Bruce's full Game of Death footage, the 90-minute dailies, are rediscovered in the vaults of Golden Harvest. And they put them out in two different documentaries, Bruce Lee, A Warrior's Journey, mm-hmm. and Bruce Lee in Game of Death, which was the Japanese counterpart to that.
Artport.
I'm sorry?
Artport,
yeah, exactly. And they, I mean, it was great. It was a great time to be a Bruce Lee fan. They showed the additional roughly 28 minutes that we didn't see in the original Game of Death. And they followed the sequence, you know, exactly to, you know, Bruce's handwritten notes as to what he was doing at the time. We were all really jazzed to see the footage. You know, again, it was a great time to be a fan. But after the initial high, I felt something was sorely lacking. And I couldn't quite place what it was, but if I had to distill it, it was the final products in both films bore little resemblance to the perfectly paced fight choreography in Bruce Lee's other films. So we were getting more Bruce Lee footage, but it wasn't actually being cut in a way that was congruent to what I knew Bruce Lee was as a storyteller. So much of that stemmed from the fact that, you know, the filmmakers obviously wanted to include all the footage for the fans. So I can't blame them for that, you know. And, you know, if they hadn't, you know, there'd be an uproar. People would be, you know, complaining about that. But, you know, ultimately, it's as much as putting that footage in was great, right, it's highly problematic when you're trying to edit and tell a story, which is what Bruce was very, very proficient at doing. He told stories through his combat, right? And, you know, within that, there was a specific narrative that was missing. So the notes that, you know, and the way they put it together, they were almost like a slave to Bruce Lee's notes, and those notes were looked at as being gospel as opposed to a work in progress, which is exactly what they were at the time. So, you know, they say that a film is always made three times. First in the writing stage, then when you actually shoot the film, and then in the editing stage. And there's almost no director in the world that's shot footage, got to the editing stage, and done it exactly the way he thought he was going to do it, because things come up, you see things, pacing problems, what you thought was a really great line or a really great piece ends up not fitting, or it slows down the pacing. So, you know, I'm 100% sure that had Bruce lived and looked at this footage, we wouldn't have gotten what he put in his notes as being at the time, because it's always constantly a work in progress. Additionally, to distance themselves from the 1978 film, they created two different soundtracks. Again, which bore, you know, little resemblance to the story that was being told. And, you know, it actually brings me to film composer John Barry and his genius. And he was the one that wrote the music for what you just saw, Game of Death 78. Barry never actually met Bruce Lee. He was hired by Raymond Chow, probably somewhere around 1977 or 78. And the idea was, you know, he was a well-known composer in Hollywood of British origin. And what he did, he was brought on board basically to give the movie an international flavor. You know, they wanted that big orchestral Hollywood sound for the movie. And that's basically what he was hired to do. And he delivered it in spades. Not only did he compose a theme that was worthy of the subject matter, but when I hear it, right, it's almost like a sonic sculpture that relays Lee's philosophical ideas and themes in a very resonant way. That's how I always viewed it. I almost can't think of the Game of Death footage without hearing John Barry's score. So, you know, with that in mind, my aim with my project was to honor both Bruce's unparalleled genius as well as John Barry's talents. I view my final product as a tribute to both men's art, and I would probably say, I'm comfortable saying that what you're going to see is probably in the vein of an extended remix of what you just saw, or as my buddy Matt Pauly called it, a cinematic novella, which to me is the highest compliment, really. Before we begin, I need to thank my amazing wife, Terry, for supporting me and everything that I do and dealing with my madness. And most importantly, she reminded me to take a step back while I was in the middle of this, you know, and she reminded me to basically let the art breathe.
That's it.
You know? Which is something that's super important when you're doing something like this. I want to thank Anthony Wong for giving me the platform and showing the interest in this. Thanks again, Anthony. You know, I can't think of a better crowd to share this with. And last but not least, I want to thank the two Matts. Matt Soul, who was my brother in arms, who physically edited my version. So, you know, he cut everything to my specifics and dealt with a lot of crazy hours and a lot of crazy nonsense in between that we won't get into. And author Matthew Pauly for writing the most accurate, most human portrait of Bruce Lee ever written. Matt, thanks for joining the game tonight. And I'll conclude just by saying that coming back to Game of Death for me 40 years after initially viewing it allowed me to rediscover its brilliance in a very intimate and cathartic way. So with that, it's a pleasure to show you the version that I've done, and I hope you enjoy it.
Again, thanks, everyone, for coming. First, I just want to say I love obsessives. Bruce Lee, obviously, is one of the great obsessives of all time. The martial arts, philosophy, trying to be a movie star. And Alan obviously caught the bug because this was an obsessive work of love, putting this together. So thank you, Alan, for doing that.
My pleasure.
So first question. We'll just begin the chat like this. I've written most of these out, so they're long-winded, so I'll try to shorten them. But Bruce filmed, obviously, in 1972, as you said, and Golden Harvest cut down that 40-plus minutes worth of material to 10 to 11, which we all saw, for their ending of the movie of Game of Death. So for them, that part was simply a kind of plot convenience to try to give the like final fight scene. John Little, who discovered the footage, we should give him credit, or it would never been, we never would be here today, put together his and the Warrior's journey, and of course there was a Japanese version. So there were three versions of Game of Death. And the question that I always get asked is, why did you need to write another Bruce Lee book? Why did you feel like you needed to do another version of Game of Death?
So the short answer is pure selfishness. I wanted to have a perfect copy of Game of Death to watch on a rainy day. None of them were cutting it for me. The one that I felt closest to would have been, actually, believe it or not, the 78 version, only because I felt that the editing that Alan Patillo did for that was closer to Bruce's sensibilities as a filmmaker. Now, when I've said this in the past, it's gotten me in trouble because I'm like, what do you mean? That they didn't show anything in that, and blah, 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 you know? But I'm talking strictly from the point of storytelling. It wasn't perfect, but it was closer to Bruce's sensibilities. So I wanted to kind of have that rendition to be able to kind of put into my DVD player and watch, you know, like the version that I wanted. But my goal was really twofold, right? I wanted to trim all the excess fat that was there in both A Warrior's Journey and Artport. And secondly, I wanted to really honor John Barry's role in Game of Death. So to that end, I just kind of made it my mission to kind of look at this footage and see and play around and figure out how it could tell Bruce's story in the most organic way, you know? And it had to be in that organic way. It couldn't just be slap John Barry's soundtrack on anywhere you feel like it'll sound good, because then all you end up with is a music video. Yeah.
So what were some of the major changes you made from the previous version? We didn't have time to show you John Little's or the Japanese version, but it's much longer, for one. So you obviously edited down some. What sort of choices did you make? Why did you make them?
So I lifted roughly 7 minutes and 36 seconds directly from Game of Death 78. Musical cues, like right in the same spot for dramatic effect. The challenge for me after that was, how do I fill out and pad out the rest, again, in an organic way? One of the deliberate choices that I used was the percussion, right? You notice that when Bruce first appears, there's a percussion sound. That's repeated later on Kareem's floor. And part of that was, I wanted to symbolize the unity between him and the other characters in the pagoda. And I wanted to use it in a way to kind of propel that symbolism and tell the story through that main theme that we hear. Because the music, I mean, it's been criticized, right, for not really being a variety. It's like that main theme repeated in very specific ways. But to me, the difference in, you know, like a key note here versus there, right, and putting it just in a slightly different key gives it a whole, like, different vibe and a whole different, it becomes a different animal to me. So I wanted to see how that would work, specifically with telling the story. Another thing that I did was cut down a lot of the dialogue, both from the Guardian's perspective and also from Bruce's thought balloons. So anybody who's watched Warrior's Journey will know that there was a series of thought bubbles that came up on, you know, while Bruce was fighting Kareem. I excised all of that stuff because the golden rule of movies, right, is show, don't tell. And Bruce was really aware of that. And again, if you look at all the Game of Death notes as a work in progress, I'd like to think that a lot of that stuff, he would have kind of come to those conclusions himself. We don't need that. One of the things that he always was so brilliant at doing was, again, telling stories through combat. And he told you all you needed to know about the characters, you know, through their appearance, through the way they moved, and through the way they interacted. I was trying to get back to the root of that with Game of Death. So not too much exposition. The stuff that I mostly kept was obviously Bruce's dialogue, which is, in effect, you know, as you brilliantly said, it's a JKD tutorial. You know, the whole cinematic novella reads like a JKD tutorial in some respect. But, that was a major thing that helped with the pacing. Also, you know, cutting little bits, you know, of extended, you know, like footage where, you know, people were just kind of mulling around or looking at each other. You know, the pacing, again, was just so slow in those other versions that I wanted to clean it up and get rid of a lot of that fat.
Tell me about the lip syncing.
That's what I was actually going to get to. So one of the things that I did, I made it like my own personal mission to find out that what that missing dialogue was.
So for people who don't know, in John Little's version, there's a point where Bruce Lee moves his mouth and there's nothing there. And so no one knew what he was saying.
Right, exactly. So, and, well, actually, so John Little kind of left it alone, and he just put missing dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then in the Japanese version, it was dubbed incorrectly. So I took it to two different lip readers, and they came back to me with the exact same thing. And it was funny, because it was one of those things that, in retrospect, where, like, you spend so much trying to figure out what could he possibly be saying. The only word that I could make out was bamboo. I was sure that that was in there. But everything else was just like a blank. I was like, I can't fucking say. What is he talking about? Right? And they came back to me, and when I matched it, I was like, oh, my God. That's so obvious. You know? Why didn't anybody else see that, including me? But yeah, that was one of the things that I was happy to kind of put to rest with that. And it, not so much footage-wise, but one thing that I also wanted to address was Bruce Lee's tracksuit, the color scheme, you know, for the nunchucks and the sneakers and the tracksuit. And there's been a lot of discussion, you know, over the years as to, like, why he chose that color scheme and what was he trying to do, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at Bruce's notes, the character that he played, retired martial arts champion, and his fighting moniker was Yellow-Faced Tiger. So it becomes pretty apparent that when you look at the tracksuit that he was just visually representing his moniker there. Everything was matching. He was wearing and promoting the colors of his moniker, Yellow-Faced Tiger. It's interesting to me, actually, that he chose to identify with the tiger in this movie, where he's obviously known as the dragon. And, you know, he had two movies with dragon in the title. You know, his nickname growing up was a little dragon. But in this movie, he really seemed to identify with the tiger. And you can actually see photos of Bruce with a tiger rug. He's bare-chested, and he's kind of posing with a tiger rug. And then he had a big tiger poster, like a visage of a tiger's face in his office at Golden Harvest. So there was a little bit of a kind of a left-field thing going on with the tiger there. It's interesting.
So Bruce famously had difficulty finishing the screenplay for Game of Death. Yeah. One of the reasons he was excited Enter the Dragon came wrong is because he didn't know how to do the rest of the story. He'd filmed these three scenes. He had a good idea of what he wanted to do for the first and second levels. So the question I had for you is, you know, at the time he was thinking, I'll have Korean gangsters kidnap my sister, and that will be the way that forces me up, which is a very B-movie type plot line.
Right.
But the Bagoda is really a kind of philosophical journey, much more in the spirit of Silent Flute. Do you feel like, in a way, if you could have possibly added one and two, this is actually the movie he wanted to make, and he just knew that 45 minutes wasn't enough? Do you think this was the kind of, the Pagoda scene was really what Bruce Lee wanted to do with Game of Death?
That's a very astute observation. I agree with that 110%. I think he struggled with, I think definitely, like, if he could have it as his cake and eat it too, we would have just seen the Pagoda. I don't think he was that much interested in telling the rest of the story. And clearly, because as you said, it reads like a bad B-movie. But are there any good B-movies? But what I was going to say was, I think, so one thing to remember is that Bruce had this idea for the Pagoda motif all the way back in 1959 when he was a teenager. And in fact, it was something that he spoke to a couple of times to Amy Sambo, his first girlfriend in Seattle, about the idea. It wasn't as fleshed out as the way it was in 1972, but he had this idea of, you know, a hero, you know, ascending a pagoda, and on every level there would be a different martial arts master. And it's funny because he was so ahead of his time with that idea. you know, alone. I mean, let's just forget the philosophical stuff, put it to the side for a second, but that has become like the basis of every video game and comic book all the way like through the 70s and 80s. You know, it was something that people revisited over and over again in different, you know, forms. And he was the first one to do it. And, you know, he had it back in like 1959, he was thinking about this stuff. You know? to answer your question, the philosophical aspect of the pagodas, I think definitely what he was striving for and all in.
And what do you think the three levels represented? Because one of the interesting things about what you did is when you reintroduce a lot of the extra material, but also the dialogue,
yeah.
You get a sense of this wasn't just an action scene to finish it. This was he was telling a story and trying to make a point. What was that point on those three levels?
Well,
for
me, the way I see it is, you know, he was drawing a lot from Zen Buddhism and Jungian psychology, right? And the idea behind it, for me, was the center of it was the loss of ego, right? And how that transforms the psyche. So if you look at, the word death, right, it's no accident that he chose to have that in the title. And it's no accident that he has a couple of people reference the word death in there and people actually dying, obviously. But I think the symbolism there is that, you could look at it that the pagoda was Bruce's own soul.
Mm.
It represented his soul. And he had to take that journey, go into it, and basically level off and kill his own ego. Conquer his fear of death. And each level of the pagoda took him closer and closer to that. I think, like, for instance, if you look at an Asanto's floor, right, mm-hmm. One of the things that's very apparent is when they're facing off against each other, they're both moving almost identical. So, in a way, an Asanto's character becomes a mirror for Bruce. Right? And he's actually, as an aside to that, he was the one that, Inosanto was actually the inspiration for the Rhythm Man character in Silent Flute.
Okay.
That Bruce was going to eventually play. But he was based on Inosanto. And this was a character that had a tribe with him, and they would bang on the drums, and then he would start to move, and he would be very, very fluid. And he was also proficient at weapons and everything. And from what I understand, Bruce really was inspired by Dan Inosanto to create that character. So here we almost have, like, he lifted that and put that there and literally had Inosanto play the Rhythm Man. And, you know, obviously Bruce beats him by breaking his rhythm, right? And within that, you almost kind of get the impression that the Inosanto character was, he was kind of like, he's a proficient martial artist. I mean, amazing, but he's too confined, you know, by the script. And he's almost like what Bruce Lee could have been if he hadn't become combatively enlightened. You know, that's the image that I get. So there is a parallel there between the two characters. And again, it's visually represented by how they move around each other, where they're like literally mirroring each other. Jihan Jay's floor is interesting because you were the one that mentioned this to me, that he literally defeats G by out-grappling him. He beats him at his own game. And it seemed like it was something really important for him to do. You know what I mean? Beyond just the fact that it was, you know, survival of the fittest and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. It seemed like that the character, it was important to him to actually beat this guy at his own game. You know, doing the things that he did. And then there's also the representation that G is the temple of the dragon, funnily enough.
Mm.
So again, we have that kind of parallel of a reflection again, where Bruce Lee, known to be the dragon, even though he's the tiger in this movie, is literally going to the temple of the dragon and fighting the metaphorical dragon there. Where it ties also into ego is there's, you know, clearly a very regal aspect to Jihan Jay's character. Bruce had designed that outfit with the gold trim and the gold belt, which, you know, didn't exist. It was something that he created visually for the film because he was trying to say something about the character. So between the grappling and the fact that, you know, it was the dragon, again, it could be looked at as another layer or you know, peeling of the onion there.
Right. And he also filmed him, I should say, as his handsome man, right? I mean, all the shots of him have got that...
Absolutely.
That very, and with the hand up, he's got that, you know, incredibly handsome, statuesque sort
of... With the
representation,
hair.
The hair, yeah.
Yeah.
And the way that he doesn't do Anna Santo or Kareem. So he was creating a kind of image. But yeah, go on. And so for the...
For Kareem's floor, yeah. you know, Kareem is... He represents the id. In Freudian psychology, you know, or you know, the shadow in Jungian psychology, he's basically Bruce's dark shadow, right? There's been a lot of talk about like exactly what Kareem was meant to represent, you know, with the eyes and this light sensitivity. Was he like a vampire or was he a mutant, et cetera, et cetera? You know, and not that those, you know. Ideas aren't like, you know, good ideas, but it's just that I think that when you come to that floor, Bruce wasn't really trying to tell the story literally at that point. He was really trying to go metaphoric in a big way. And, you know, there are so many little things that, you know, give that away, right? For instance, when he first walks on the floor and he sees Kareem and he's awed by Kareem's size, you know, he slowly tilts his head up in awe like this. And you immediately cut to Kareem, who's standing away from him, who literally does the exact same thing. He mimics the head movement the same way Bruce does, literally being his shadow at that moment. So Bruce is looking up like this, and then you cut to that long shot, and Kareem is also lifting his head up like this, kind of defiantly. On top of that, I also think that Kareem represents Bruce's fear, fear of the unknown. So in a big effect, you know, fighting that dark shadow, the battle with Kareem is essentially Bruce conquering himself and his own fears.
Right.
You know, that's how I read it anyway, or I'd like to read it.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Bruce was heavy into, you know, Zen Buddhism, and, you know, he had a library that was, you know, just like an unending library. A lot of that stuff he incorporated into his films, and, you know, he was so ahead of his time because... Your average person who wants to just go see a good action film, you know, isn't really seeing this kind of stuff. But he had ways, you know, he always talked about wanting to make multi-level films. And, you know, this is his way of doing it. You know, you can go back to it and you can read these different things. Of course, you know, on the flip side, people say, well, you might be reading too much into that. But I don't know. Like, you know, when you look at how Bruce approached things, he was very, very meticulous and, you know, his wheels are always turning. It's...
Right.
It was rarely just what it was.
Right.
There was always something behind it.
And he defeats him by putting the light on.
Yeah, right? Right. He literally shines the light on the shadow, and the shadow disappears.
And so he brings light onto the darkness.
Yeah.
And of course, he casts an African-American and tall one, too, right, which is problematic. But it fits the kind of shadow, Jungian shadow.
Yeah.
And he fights the style of no style, which is Jeet Kune Do. So he's fighting himself. So
yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because I wanted to read this quote, right? Ego loss, right? The loss of ego is described as complete transcendence, beyond words, beyond space, time, beyond self. There are no visions, no sense of self, no thoughts. There are only pure awareness and ecstatic freedom. Does that sound familiar? I mean, that's the JKD mission statement.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about Bruce Lee as a filmmaker. He famously tried to make The Silent Flute for many years.
Yeah.
And that was a very overtly philosophical or pedagogical movie. Preachy, one might say.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he went to Hong Kong and he made two straight-out B-movie revenge flicks.
Right.
In which he was awesome in, but they were not the kind of storytelling that he was thinking about in Hollywood. And then when he went to make his own movie, he kind of did a hybrid, which was Way of the Dragon is basically a revenge film. Right. He's called in to protect the family who've been harmed by this mafia gang. But in one particular scene where he's fighting Chuck Norris, which is the most famous kung fu fight scene of all times, he manages to embed JKD philosophy within it. He's fighting Chuck and losing until he loosens up and uses broken rhythm and changes his style. And I've always felt like with this, when, once you see the 40 minutes, you're like, oh, that's Chuck Norris. Only we added three more levels and three different fighters. And do you feel like that sort of Bruce Lee in Game of Death was really trying to do, as a filmmaker, the fight scene with embedding sort of, with just a touch of dialogue to hint you in the right direction, the philosophical mission?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, to me, the most the most interesting thing about Way of the Dragon is the fight scene. Actually, the three fight scenes in the end, but obviously the Chuck Norris one. And there was a definitive story that was being told there. The story that I feel that I took from that one was that a rite of passage was happening for this character, that the fight symbolized a rite of passage. And, I think that one of the things that Bruce kind of really adhered to when he was doing fight choreography was the highest art, being the highest art kind of being like triumph over the loss of art, right? Which is a really kind of heady kind of thing to absorb. But he had he was very influenced by D.T. Suzuki, and specifically a book called Zen and Japanese Culture that Suzuki wrote. A lot of the things that he kind of, a lot of the parables and a lot of the stuff that he would slip into his movies come directly from that book. So if you guys are interested in that, I suggest you pick up that book. You'll see like where all those things are. You're like, oh my God, he lifted from this, he lifted from that. But the thing about it is that he was able to do it so brilliantly, right? He was able to kind of put that in the fight choreography and make that choreography so sexy that you almost kind of, like, if you had a choice between looking at that versus reading the book, that, where the source is like, oh, fuck, I'm looking at that,
Right.
That's really where it is for me, right? And his cinematic battles were kind of almost like, the way I viewed them, they're like fables, right? They're fables of, triumphs of the spirit as well as triumphs of the flesh,
And we didn't discuss this before, but I just wanted to jump in. One of the things, by adding that material, you get Bruce's sense of humor.
Yeah.
Right, whereas in the 78, it's just a kind of grim slog through a beating, right?
Yeah.
And by adding the two companions, who are a bit of kind of clowns, right? There's a kind of Three Stooges aspect
to it,
where they're, they're waving them over.
Right.
But you get the sense of Bruce as a filmmaker and what he wanted to do tonally. How did, when you were editing it, did you feel like you needed to tweak a little bit here and there? Because he famously, in Way of the Dragon, had the difficulty of the first part's funny and then it gets grim and they don't quite match.
Right. I kept most of the stuff, most of the banter, because, to your point, it was definitely needed. And it actually showed his growth as a filmmaker in terms of being able to marry that. I mean, the pacing to this day is still great. There's nothing in it that really reads or feels false. The thing about it is that, to answer your question, I didn't really cut too much out. The most that I cut out was some of those lingering shots where after a glance, or a gesture was done, there was that little extra of just hanging on to the scene.
Right.
That's what I excised. But, I didn't really excise anything in terms of the humor because I felt it was needed. I mean, there was humor even in the combat when, he does that baseball pitch punch.
Right.
Which I was just like,
On Kareem, where you like...
Right. I mean, it's like, how... That's dying to be in there, If you knew anything about Bruce, you knew he would have used that cut. He wouldn't have used the other one. just because he's trying to make a point. For those of you who are familiar or you've read anything about Game of Death, Bruce had narrated into a recording that the opening scene was going to involve an open view of an expanse of snow where there was an oak tree and a willow tree, and then there's a whole bunch of snow. The oak tree breaks right through the wind, and then the willow tree is moving around and stays alive because it's able to adapt. Right? We're not entirely sure if that was the opening he wanted for Game of Death. It's very possible that that could have been the opening for Southern Fist, Northern Leg. At the time when he actually dictated that into the microphone, he was working on Southern Fist, Northern Leg. And he thought that that was going to be his next movie. If you want more details on that, I highly recommend you pick up Matt Polly's book because he knows about. It's a little like there, right? But basically, so I'm not entirely sure if that was even going to open the movie. Right. That could have been the opening for Southern Fist Northern Lake.
But it continued his fascination with adaptability.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
So last question, then we'll open up for Q&A.
Yeah.
Bruce famously wanted to go Hong Kong to be for him what Clint Eastwood's Italy was for Clint Eastwood. It was the place he was going to prove his bankability so he could come back to Hollywood and make movies. And so his idea was Way of the Dragon, which he wrote, directed, and starred in, would be his ticket back. But when he saw it, he was insecure about it and didn't think it was quite good enough. And so he was hoping Game of Death would be his The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It would be his Spaghetti Eastern. Now, the question I have is, you work with the material. Do you think he would have succeeded? And also, this requires conjecture. What do you think he would have done post Enter the Dragon success with this 35, 40 minutes of material that he had filmed?
Great question. And I'm going to answer it from a few different angles. I think that if Bruce had finished Game of Death, do I think that it would have crossed over into the international market? It's hard to say, but I doubt it. I don't think that this was the vehicle. I think the Pagoda footage was amazing, but if he had filmed it with that B-movie plot line to begin with, then it's like, you know, it would have been like throwing caution to the wind and see what sticks, you know? He wasn't able to do it with Way of the Dragon. I don't think that he was yet ready as a director of non-action pieces to make the other stuff work.
Right.
So from that perspective, no. Do I think that I also think that Lee needed the experience of working on a movie like Enter the Dragon, you know, with Hollywood, to help him grow and see the narrative and what he could do with his own films. You know, because he spent a significant amount of time looking at the stuff that was non-action.
Right.
So it was a good experience for him. I think that, you know, maybe after Enter the Dragon, he could have gone and made something that at that point would have. But, you know, at that point, with the success of Enter the Dragon, it wouldn't have really mattered because he would have been such a household name that anybody would have, you know, gone based just on, you know, the success of Enter. I don't think that Game of Death would have been his philosophical masterpiece in any way, shape, or form. When I think philosophical masterpiece, I think The Silent Flute directed by Akira Kurosawa. Hmm. That, to me,
right.
has the... You know what I mean? If we're going to call anything that, that's right. probably it. But that being said, I think that if he had just made a short film or a cinematic novella
right.
of the five floors, you know, that in of itself would have been a philosophical masterpiece.
Right.
Just not with the rest of the stuff.
Right.
You know? On the flip side, though, I have to say that I think that it's interesting. One thing that, you know, we should say is that the Hai Tien character is the closest character to what Bruce Lee was really like, if you think about it. Like, the way the character presented himself, you know, the constant pontificating, the cocky arrogance that he brought, you know, to all to his opponents in Game of Death was very much in line with how Bruce Lee was in real life. So when people talk about, like, well, you know, Tang Lung from Way of the Dragon is, you know, no. Bruce wasn't a country bumpkin that would show up at an airport and, you know, just stand there and let a woman stare at him without telling her where to go. You know what I mean? Or whatever, you know? So it's like, if we're really going to analyze and say who was the closest type of character that he ever played on film, it would probably be the Hai Tien character. And also, you know, aside from the tracksuit, which was very representative, you know, of Western culture, I think that he's, you know, it was his most Western character, really.
Right.
You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in a documentary, once stated that he believed the Jeet Kune Do was essentially American. He said that it borrowed heavily from Asian arts, right? But how it was born, the philosophy behind it, the rebellion, the anti-establishment was uniquely American. And I kind of view what Bruce was doing in the Pagoda being kind of a an extension of that. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
So, some of you I know need to go, but I don't want to deprive anybody of the chance to ask some questions after patiently sitting here for nearly 2 hours. So, yes, ma'am, in the back.
So, we're in dual obsessions in household.
Uh-huh.
And watching the movie is very Dr. No. It's not unreasonable considering the time and it was the same composer. There's a lot of Kareem sitting in the chair, very Dr. No, I could almost see the Chinese girl in You Only Live Twice with the same sort of the way the bamboo wall, I guess, flies up and suddenly it has holes in it.
Uh-huh.
But it was. I'm not that good at Bruce Lee, but I'm pretty good at Bond.
Uh-huh.
it was very, very similar.
Oh, great.
And that, but that in itself might have given it international appeal.
Right.
At that time.
That's a great.
So
point.
That's what could have been at, on the final floor. That was the treasure, the Chinese girl.
It was a contract to play James Bond.
Right.
No, but that's a great point, and I actually hadn't heard that before. My Bond knowledge is not as good as my Bruce knowledge, but I think you have a point, which is Bruce was obsessed with James Bond for a long time, and of course Enter the Dragon was very much supposed to be a kind of Chinese knockoff version of James Bond, and he was several times throughout his life he would pitch something and he'd be like, yeah, this will be like a jazzy, coolie James Bond kind of thing. And so he was very conscious of that as a kind of role model for him of the kind of movies he wanted to make. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if some of those things were conscious choices that he made. Hector.
Well, I'm going to be careful asking this question, being that I'm sitting next to Jihan Jay's daughter. So
yes, we didn't. Sorry, we didn't want to embarrass her, but yes.
But my question is, why do you think Bruce Lee chose Korea as the location for this movie?
You want to answer that first?
I have no idea.
honestly,
I never figured that out, so you tell me.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think that there was anything significant, per se, about Korea, that he was trying to specifically say something about Korea. I think that he just liked the temple, the Pope Juzoth temple, and he liked the fact that the Buddha was overlooking that big golden Buddha. I don't know if you guys saw that in the first frame there, but there was a big, huge golden Buddha overlooking the pagoda. So I think from a visual aesthetic, he just, it resonated with him, and he said, let's go do it there,
right.
He also chose Korean gangsters. I mean, they were Korean.
Yeah, I think that
characters. In
you're right. Yeah, and again, I don't think that there's any real significance other than the fact that if we're going to Korea, we might as well make it Korean gangsters.
Right.
But actually, a better question would be why the Italian mob in The Way of the Dragon only spoke English. But that's another. Sorry. Actually, that was a question for you. I wanted you to.
I'll answer it.
But Jihan Jay was somebody who'd just been hired by Golden Harvest, so he knew he had that talent there.
Yeah.
And I often think that there might. I think you're right. I think mostly he just dug that pagoda. He'd seen it in pictures or whatever, and it was the visual image is what he wanted. But they also, Golden Harvest was thinking about the ways to dominate various parts of East Asia, and so having a film set in Korea would have made business sense as well, because then they would have probably done a film with the Japanese related topic.
That's a great point.
So it wouldn't surprise me if that was going on in Raymond Chow's mind, but we don't have any evidence of that.
Yeah.
Alec.
Given how little we know about the framework of how Bruce was going to finish his movie, how would George Lazenby have fit into this? Supposedly he was going to meet him. We're on the eve of the day he was going to meet him to have, a meeting about finishing Game of Death.
Yeah.
I'm very curious how that would have fit in.
I mean, boy, you could just speculate for days trying to come up with that. I mean, clearly they would have, I think, he had this thing firmly set, the pagoda, and so everything that he was struggling with was how to get essentially it's a MacGuffin. You've got a MacGuffin at the top of the fifth floor, and all he wants to do is tell the philosophical story of how Jeet Kune Do fights and how you're supposed to adapt and kill your shadow, and he's telling a Jungian story. And this he knows because he spent 20 years thinking about it. But he doesn't know how to get him to the thing, so he's got like some ridiculous, you kidnap my daughter, which is completely counter to a philosophical kind of movie. So he's got two things that don't go together, and that's why he can't finish it. And then Lazenby, famously, who played James Bond, shows up, and they're like, well, let's stuff him in the movie, right? Because this is Hong Kong filmmaking. They're like, we'll find a part. So he probably would have been the guy who worked with the Korean gangsters and like tried to get a man, and maybe they just stuck him on the final floor, right?
Well, the thing about it is that supposedly, according to Lazenby in interviews, is that he says that he played Bruce's a guru, that he was a spiritual teacher.
Oh, I see.
And that, you know, that he, you know, Bruce was very physical, but he was more like wise. So like how he would have fit into this, oh my God. Like I don't even think that Bruce could have pulled this off in terms of like looking at it and going, what the fuck? Really? Dude, you know what I mean? I honestly think, honestly, the more and more I hear it, this is just my personal opinion, so nobody, like, go crazy, right? But honestly, this whole Lazenby thing reads to me like Lazenby came to Hong Kong, and Bruce is like, oh, yeah, he used to be a Bond, you know? Let's get him in some way. Yeah. And then you know, they meet, and then he's like, oh, sure, you want to hire me? He's like, yeah, we'll figure something out. Oh, you'll be my guru. But I honestly don't feel that Bruce had any idea how to use them. That's my personal opinion. But yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, George Lazenby at the time was out of job.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He flew to Hong Kong, and he was, I mean, hey, since this character Bruce Lee is so famous, why don't I try to see if I can make some money or get a job?
Yeah.
And he went to see Raymond Chow, and Raymond Chow said, "Oh, okay, I know about it. You make one bond, and that's a bomb." Bruce was shooting a movie inside.
Right.
And Raymond Chow actually went to Bruce. He said, "Hey, Bruce, this guy George Lazenby is a Bond, and he would like to see you. Do you have time?" Yeah. And Bruce said, "Literally, Bruce said, no, I don't have time." So Lazenby actually, I mean, kind of left, but I mean, later on, Bruce told Raymond, "I mean, why don't you, I mean, tell him?" I mean, I want to see him and see what he can do.
Right.
So, I mean, it's almost like a relationship that, I mean, and George Lazenby finally got to see Bruce, and Bruce said, okay, I will think of something that you can do in my movie.
Exactly, yeah.
And not only that, Bruce went to Raymond, he said, "Hey, Chow, come here, give the guy $10,000,
yeah.
U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
And Raymond Chow said, why? He said, just consider it's a down payment.
Right. Yeah.
And George Lazenby basically got an okay from Bruce.
Yeah.
And say that, I'm okay. We meet him in dinner and we try to work out a little bit of detail.
Right.
It's too
right. But that's very much how Hong Kong filmmaking was done. Like, you didn't really have a script.
Yeah.
Somebody showed up on the day and they're like, okay, you get to be the cousin. And like, you know, and then they sat on the scene and it was very improvisational because they had all worked with each other a lot. So they had a kind of comfort, and they were kind of due to Lazenby that he had a certain international appeal. He had some fame, and in Hong Kong at that time,
he was so broke, he took a bus.
Yeah, yeah.
Golden Harbor.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bruce is like, if James Bond has to take a bus, you better give him $10,000 so we can get a cab home.
I thought for sure you were going to say, if James Bond has to take a bus, we're all screwed.
It doesn't look good.
All right, you in the back, sir.
Yeah, okay. I mentioned when Matthew was here last time that Kareem was one of the few people that I actually talked to about Bruce. I was always one or two people removed from Bruce and never got to be at any of his tournaments or anything. But I once asked Kareem about the size difference.
Mm.
He said I wore a cup a lot, you know, because of the size difference.
Sure.
And everything.
Right.
But of the original characters, including Kareem, did you go back and get any new voiceover from the original characters? Did you have to go get new voiceovers?
It's a great question. Yes. So without getting too much into editing language, right, a big part of my problem was that I didn't have the actual 35 millimeter print that had no sound for me to be able to just slap on whatever I wanted in increments. And I'm talking about dialogue, I'm talking about music, and I'm talking about Foley sound, which a lot of people don't pay attention to. That's just the incidental things that you hear, like, or whatever. For me, this project was very much a Frankenstein monster in the sense that I was taking bits from here, there, recreating things. And a lot of times I had to recreate things from scratch because the version that I was using had music on it that I didn't want to use. Mm. Even like little music. You know, I was adamant that everything had to be John Barry. So, yes, to answer your question, I had to go back and I had to recreate the dialogue for James Tien's character on floor two. I ended up dubbing Bruce's voice for the lost dialogue, as well as four other places, again, because of music, not because of vanity. And, even little incidental things like people sighing and, you know, breathing and some of Bruce's war cries. All that stuff I had to, you know, fit in and dub myself. And I was actually surprised that it came out as seamlessly as it did. Because while I was doing it, I was thinking to myself, holy shit, this is just going to sound so incongruent, you know? But, you know.
It worked. One more question. I thought you had one. Yeah.
I was just going to ask you: have either one of you met Kareem? Ever met Kareem?
No. So I got to his manager, and his manager said, you know, he'll only talk to you if you have the Bruce Lee Estate's approval. And so at that point, since Shannon was unhappy,
so
that
she
I
makes the decisions, or is it like mostly Linda? Or does she
no, Shannon controls Linda. Linda's retired, so Shannon controls the estate.
She
did, and so we worked together at the beginning, but then when I interviewed Betty Ting Pei, that was a no-go for the estate. They don't do anything related to Bruce's extramarital affairs or his death, and so that meant that I was no longer within the realm of how they want to talk about Bruce, which of course is their right. They get to talk about him however they want to, but so do we, right?
Yeah.
So Kareem is very close to the estate, which is their long sort of relationship, and so that I wanted to, but that's why I didn't.
I have not.
Yeah,
I have
not. Yeah. And also, just in general, the more famous a person gets, the more it makes you want to poke yourself in the eyes trying to get to them, right? Because they have managers and agents and things to get through, and also they answer a lot of questions, so they tell you the same thing over and over again because they've already answered it 30 times. So you actually, once you get to them after torturing yourself, they tell you the same thing you've gotten in 12 other magazine interviews. So at a certain point, you start going, why am I going to kill myself to go to Kareem? I'll just, you know, take what I have over here. So that's how it generally works as a biographer. But yes, in a certain way, this is very much a guerrilla project.
Yeah, 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 very much. It's a true Frankenstein monster.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question. Anybody?
Yeah, I was curious about the Sign of Blue, you know, the original title thing, and then how did it go from the Sign of Blue to the Game of Death?
I'm sorry?
How did the movie go from the Sign of Blue?
Yeah, they're different projects.
They are?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all right, because he had a bunch of projects he couldn't finish, and they all have similarities. But the Silent Flute was a screenplay he did with Sterling Siliphant and James Coburn that they tried to make into a movie in about 19, am I right, 68?
69.
69, thank you.
Actually going into 70.
69, 70, and even into 71.
Okay.
Yeah, and so this... And that was before he went to Hong Kong and made The Big Boss.
Yeah.
And so then he made The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Way of the Dragon, and this, Game of Death, was his next project.
So that was always his title? Always
no, so the title changed. It was going to be, he was going to do Yellowface Tiger.
Yeah.
So this, now we're in the weeds.
Right.
But he had the title Yellowface Tiger, and then he ended up fighting with another director over this, and so he changed it to Game of Death. And so once he started filming, though, I do think Game of Death was always the title.
I will say this, though, because we didn't address it, right? I don't think, I didn't answer your question, I don't think, what's so unique about this footage, beyond the fact that it's unfinished, right, is that my honest belief, right, is that if Bruce had lived, and after the success of Enter the Dragon, he would not have gone back and finished Game of Death, this version. What he would have done, we would have seen a Game of Death, That much I'm sure of. And it would have been a pagoda, and he would have been wearing the tracksuit. But this particular footage, which was produced in Hong Kong using Hong Kong money, which was a limited budget, he then could have gone and recreated the whole thing after the success of Enter the Dragon with Hollywood money. So at best, what we saw right here would have just served as a blueprint for him making it 100 times, not better, but not necessarily better, but with more money. So this quite literally would have been might have been an artifact. It might have been something that just stayed in Bruce's vaults,
right,
and said that was a blueprint, the rough version of my art before it became the Mona Lisa.
Right. It'd have been a great DVD extra.
Definitely.
Although I think he might have kept the Kareem stuff, because getting like the NBA superstar to film that stuff twice.
Yeah.
Would have been hard. They were actually mad at each other by the time the filming was over. So.
Before we wrap up, just a quick show of hands. How many people here have read Matt Pauley's book?
Oh, stop. Thank you.
Okay. So you got all the rest of you guys have not read Matt Pauley's book. Okay. So here's my thing, okay? Here's my thing. I'm going to give you guys my email address, okay? What I want you to do, purchase a copy of Matt's book, okay? If you don't like it, if you read this and you say, you know what, I didn't get anything out of this, I will give you the money for it. And I'm saying this on camera right now, so there's no way for me
all
to
right,
get out of it.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. It's very nice of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, and go